is Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who, like you, knows tax day looms dead ahead. Endless forms, paperwork, headaches, and heartaches. I calculate it's time to add a bit of fun into the mix. This week, the Book Report puts the spotlight on humor, with books to distract and entertain you. In addition, I'll speak with two authors famous for their delightfully wild and wacky worldviews. So crank up the radio and tackle the TurboTax as we turn to page one of the Book Report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Francis McManus has earned kudos as a humor columnist for Outdoor Life, Field & Stream, and several other magazines. The New York Times Book Review writes, "Everybody should read Patrick McManus." So, the Book Report is pleased to bring you The Horse in My Garage and Other Stories, a collection of the author's reflections on childhood, everyday life, and of course, outdoor tales. We follow the antics of Patrick's friends, Rancid Crabtree and Rhett Sweeney, in stories that include Shaping Up for the Hunt and Bear Hunters. McManus plays off the recent obsession with hoarders in The Lady Who Kept Things. In the title story, we'll meet Patrick's horse, Huckleberry, and experience the many challenges of owning your own horse and stabling it in your garage. Sean Pratt narrates.
One day, as a freshman at Washington State College, now university, I was browsing through the magazine section of Holland Library and came across two magazines aimed at writers and would-be writers. It was at that moment I discovered there was such a thing as freelance writing. That's for me, I thought. I couldn't imagine an employer dumb enough to hire me, and I wouldn't want to work for somebody that dumb anyway. But here was a form of work where one could be his own boss. It never occurred to me that I would still be working for someone pretty dumb. From then on, I began writing features for magazines and newspapers. By the time I graduated from college, I had sold dozens of features. Typically, I was paid $25 for a piece, but there were lots of cheap publications around, too. Still, I loved the work, regardless of the rate of pay. Eventually, I was hired by Eastern Washington State College of Education, now Eastern Washington University, as an instructor in journalism. I had summers off to devote my time entirely to freelancing. All of the stories I wrote in those early years were factual. Two of the factual articles are included in this collection and pretty much represent the high point of my article writing. Even though both are factual, I think the one thing that distinguishes them is that each has a touch of humor. One is Wildlife in a Room with a View, originally published by Sports Illustrated and later abridged by Reader's Digest. The other is $7,000 Television Extravaganza, published by TV Guide. During this period, I wrote every night for 2 hours, 7 nights a week, and I tried never to miss a writing session or to cut one short. One night, in the first hour of my 2-hour session, I finished an article on the use of telemetry in the study of wildlife, whereby wild animals are hooked up with radio transmitters so scientists can follow their travels at night. I finished writing the article in the first hour of my session and still had an hour to go. So, I decided to write a piece of nonsense to fill up my last hour. The idea for the piece was that eventually all animals will be equipped with radios, and this will simplify hunting a great deal. As was my practice at the time, anything I wrote I sent off to a magazine. This piece went to Field and Stream because it touched on hunting. One day I went out to the mailbox, and there was a small envelope from Field and Stream. Freelance writers tend to get excited over small envelopes as opposed to large envelopes. Large envelopes contain the rejected manuscript, and small envelopes contain checks. I ripped open the small envelope, and it contained a check for $350. Now, I had just sold a factual article for $750, but it had taken me a month to research and write. This piece of nonsense had taken me an hour. At that instant, I became a humor writer. Also included in this collection is my very first published fiction, The Lady Who Kept Things. I wrote it in a creative writing class, and it was later published in Spark, the student literary magazine at WSU. The instructor never thought much of my writing and refused to give me a grade higher than a B. We often had to read a story aloud to the class, and one day I read one of my humor pieces. The class laughed themselves sick. Even the instructor had to take off his glasses and wipe away tears of mirth. Back came the paper with a grade of B. I stormed into the professor's office and cried, "How could you give me a grade of B on this story when the class loved it, and even you had to wipe away tears?" He said, "Yes, McManus, it was a very funny story, but this is a class in the writing of serious literature, and you have to admit that story wasn't serious." I offer this as a word of warning to anyone interested in a career as a humor writer. Indeed, once I received a letter from an editor asking me to write for his magazine. "But not humor," he said. "It's too dangerous." Yeah, well, he should try writing it.
That was The Horse in My Garage and Other Stories by Patrick McManus. My friend Dave Barry claims he's been a professional humorist ever since he discovered that writing humor professionally was a lot easier than working. For many years, Dave wrote a newspaper column that appeared in more than 500 newspapers. I met Dave during my years at the Miami Herald. Dave won the Pulitzer Prize for Commentary, which is, to be sure, a most laudable achievement. However, ask Dave about his most enduring achievement, and he'll cite one of his columns, the one that inspired September 19th, as International Talk Like a Pirate Day. Arg. Dave has written more than 30 books, two of which were the basis for the CBS sitcom Dave's World. Today, we'll speak with him about his newest title, Insane City. Welcome, Dave. It's so great to have you back on the Book Report.
It's great to be here on the Book Report.
Insane City is set in South Florida and centers on a large wedding. Was your inspiration for the book based on a personal experience?
It was indeed. My son got married about 3 years ago, and he and his fiance then decided, because they both live in Florida, in Miami, and all their friends are in Florida and Miami, and all their relatives, that they would hold their wedding in New York, because the key to a wedding, modern industrial wedding, is to have it be as expensive as humanly possible. So I kind of was, you know, thinking about big weddings. And then, of course, I love my daughter-in-law. She is great. But she went crazy the way brides do right before weddings, where they begin to think that the florist and the caterer and these things are more important than the actual groom, for just to name one element of the wedding. And so I just came up with this idea of there are two really insane institutions that I am personally familiar with. One is the city of Miami and the other is weddings. And I thought, well, let's put a wedding in Miami and see what happens.
All right. So obviously planning a big fancy wedding is always fraught with anxiety and, yes, insanity. So how would you suggest lovers tie the knot?
Well, I mean, they won't do it. None of them will ever do this. And every parent has probably suggested this, outside of, for example, maybe Queen Elizabeth. The rest of us say, you know what? Have a little wedding You know, just a little one, just your family and your close friends. Don't make a big deal of it. We'll give you the extra money and you'll really be grateful later on down the road. But of course, that never actually happens. This is why I think people's second or third weddings generally get smaller and more practical, not just because you don't want to make such a big deal the second or third time, so much as you begin to realize, oh, it really is just a party. The actual marriage that follows is probably the most significant thing. And that doesn't, you know, have anything to do with how big and elaborate the wedding was.
All right. So the governor of Florida is a guest of the wedding in the book. Do politicians from the Sunshine State just naturally offer up more fodder for you than, let's say, a governor of Ohio or Indiana?
Yeah. I mean, we are... We're Florida. And I always say our motto is Florida. You can't spell it without duh. And we have consistently elected, not just at the state level, but also at the local level here in Miami, the most amazing array of incompetence and criminals and criminal incompetence. And so, I mean, I'm not saying this necessarily reflects on the current governor of Florida, but I did want the governor of Florida to be a kind of a sleazy, kind of a comical character, and that's what he is.
You've made South Florida your home, and you've raised a family down here. What would your advice be to a young couple, say, from Nebraska, who might contemplate moving down here and building a life?
From Nebraska, definitely come heavily armed. No, it's... You know, it all depends on who you are. And this is kind of what will be a semi-serious answer. My joke is I moved to Miami in 1986 from the United States. You have to accept, if you're going to live here in Miami, if you're going to like living here in Miami, that you are not really living in the conventional United States. There are people from many, many different countries here. I mean, the image is it's all Cubans, but it's not. It's Europeans and all over South and Central America, in addition to Cuba, and all over the Caribbean. But it's definitely an extremely diverse place. Now, I love that. I've loved it from the start that, you know, there are so many neighborhoods here, so many restaurants here. You just don't know. You know, there's nothing predictable about the city. All these different cultures sort of bouncing off each other all the time. Sometimes with scary results, but a lot of times with kind of delightful, surprising results. It's a great town if you enjoy partying, if you enjoy kind of a lot of energy and a lot of excitement. If you expect it to be like Omaha, you will hate it. You'll hate it. It is not as predictable as most cities, and is not as kind of, it doesn't have that comfort zone where you get to know the whole city's culture pretty quickly and then you just sort of settle in. There is no culture. It's like 53 different cultures and 53 different neighborhoods, and they change every 2 weeks. So you kind of have to be up for that. But if you enjoy, that kind of diversity and excitement and exoticness, you'll love Miami if you just give it a chance.
Who doesn't love Miami? Yeah. All right, changing tacks for a moment. Can you comment on the way you've illustrated chicken nuggets and that they might be hazardous to your health?
Well, I did. There's a scene in the book, and I believe it's the first time this has ever been done. And I include Tolstoy in this statement. Any author has ever had a boat chase involving a pirate ship, which is being pursued by a tourist boat, where the pirate ship defends itself by shooting frozen chicken nuggets out of a cannon at the and actually this tactic works. I don't know why the pirates didn't think of doing this in their day, but it works very effectively in this book. And I'm quite proud of that accomplishment.
But there were no fatalities.
Nobody is killed in this book. In fact, it's a weird book in that there's no real bad guy. I mean, there are people who you don't admire and there are people you don't like maybe, but everybody's sort of pursuing his own ends and you can sort of understand everybody's motives and what they're doing. So even though a lot of stuff happens, you never, as someone would say, I want that person dead. You know, I wanted to write a book where nobody is even badly hurt anywhere in it. And yet it feels like there's some kind of danger all the time.
Speaking of another food related question, any backlash from animal lovers about the cruelty of feeding Cheetos to orangutan?
Well, a key character in this book is Trevor, the orangutan, who not only is sort of an action hero, but becomes a little bit of a love interest. He's been in a cage a long time alone and he falls in love. Twice, once with the woman who becomes sort of the key female protagonist in the book, and with the sister of the bride. Trevor likes her a lot. He's not that picky, to be honest. The two women he encounters, he falls in love with both of them. But he does get fed Cheez-Its, because that's because I happen to be a big fan of Cheez-Its, and he likes them very much. But I haven't heard from any animal rights people. I did hear from one organization that that cares for great apes, and they kind of liked the way Trevor, I kind of present Trevor as a very sympathetic character who is kind of bored and lonely in his cage and wants to get out and be somebody, you know. So that was the only reaction I got, and it was positive.
You've had movies based on your books and also an award-winning Broadway play. How involved were you in the process of these, and was one way more fun than the other?
They've all been fun because I haven't had to do anything for any of them. The movie Big Trouble was, I mean, I enjoyed it. They shot it here in South Florida, and it was a big production, and I enjoyed watching it. And they were very gracious. They welcomed me on the set, probably because I never suggested anything. I, you know, was just happy to be there, and they paid me for the book, so I was thrilled about that. The Broadway play, again, I have basked in its glory, but I didn't really do anything. Rick Ellis, who wrote Jersey Boys, wrote it, and it's fantastic. It's wonderful. It's lovely, you know. But it's really Rick's adaptation of Ridley's and my story. So I've loved going to see it and beginning to hang around with the cast and everything. But I haven't had to actually do anything or take any responsibility. So that's been good for me.
Are you working on another Peter novel?
No, I think we're done with the Starcatcher series, which was great. It was a wonderful ride for us, Ridley Pearson and I. And our understanding is they are about to make Peter and the Starcatchers into a movie. Not the play, but the movie based on adapted from our book. And the guy directing it, I think his name is Gary Ross, who was the director of The Hunger Games. So he's this hot director. And so I think it might actually get made into a movie. Usually you don't ever assume anything like that, but it seems like a pretty good bet now. And that's pretty exciting.
What's your next project for adults?
For me, I wrote a collection of essays, original essays, a couple years ago called I'll Mature When I'm Dead, which I was published in 2010, and I'm going to write another one. I've been sort of collecting topics that I want to write. Like my daughter is having a bat mitzvah, which turns out to be whoa. I mean, I'm not Jewish. My wife's Jewish. My daughter's being raised Jewish. I myself am going to hell probably, but it's been fascinating. And that's one thing I would like to write an essay about and a bunch of other things. So that's if I ever finish talking about Insane City, I am going to write another book that will be a collection of essays.
And what are your final thoughts about Insane City?
Well, I love this book. Actually, this is my favorite book that I've ever written. I just like the way the story came together. And it just, I don't know, Carl Hyacin, the great South Florida writer, has long talked about how you really cannot beat South Florida as a kind of a character almost in your books. And I really tried to get the feel of Miami into this book, and I think it kind of worked. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah, I loved it too. Well, thanks, Dave. I mean, I love this book, Insane City, laugh out loud. Thanks a million.
Thank you, Elaine.
And now let's listen to a sample of Insane City, narrated by Dave himself.
2 days before his wedding, Seth was in a cab with his best man, Marty, who was advising him on the responsibilities of the groom. Your job, Marty said, is to get hammered. I've seen the movies, said Seth. It never ends well. It's a tradition, said Marty. The groom, about to give up his old lifestyle forever, spends one last night partying with his buddies, laughing with them, crying with them, throwing up on them, said Seth. Not on the best man, advised Marty. That's the function of the lower-ranking groomsman. The cab was approaching the American Airlines terminal at Reagan Airport. One thing, said Seth, no stripper. Seriously? If a stripper shows up, I will run. I will run like the wind. Strippers are traditional, said Marty. Strippers are hookers. Remember the one we got for Kevin? Marty made a face. Okay, I'll admit hygiene was not her. She was disgusting, Marty. She personally controlled 2/3 of the world's supply of stank. I'd rather get a lap dance from Charles Barkley. You want us to get Charles? Because I hear he's pretty responsive to fan requests. No stripper, that's what I want. They were pulling up to the curb. I got this, said Marty, paying the cabbie, which was unlike him. You go inside. I got to get my suitcase. I'll get it. You're the groom, man. Let people cater to you. Seth frowned. It was also unlike Marty to cater. Marty was, by nature, a cateree.
Feeling a twinge of suspicion, Seth put a hand on Marty's shoulder, leaned in eye to eye. "Marty," he said, "swear to me on your mother that there will be no stripper." "Absolutely. I swear on my mother. May she rest in peace." "Your mother's still alive?" "Unfortunately, yes. Now go find the rest of the groom posse." The rest of the groom posse consisted of Kevin, he of the stanky stripper, and Big Steve. The four of them, Seth, Marty, Kevin, and Big Steve, had been close friends since they met as roommates at the University of Delaware, where they had distinguished themselves by amassing the largest vertical stack of used pizza delivery boxes in the school's history, and quite possibly in the annals of higher education. After graduating, they had pursued different career paths, but they remained close friends, connected by the bond of college, as well as the bond of being unsuccessful at everything they had tried since. Seth spotted the hulking mass that was Big Steve by a boarding pass machine, his finger hovering uncertainly over the touch screen, his face scrunched into a frown, looking like a man about to enter the code that would launch a nuclear strike against Pyongyang, as opposed to a man confirming his selection of an aisle seat. Big Steve was a man who always wanted to make absolutely sure of everything. Standing behind him in a movie concession line was a nightmare. He could take 5 full minutes to choose a beverage before moving on to the far more difficult issue of what size beverage, not to mention the popcorn decision, which more than once had made him miss the beginning of a feature film. Pacing around Big Steve like a small jittery asteroid orbiting a planet was Kevin, who as always was on his cell phone, lying to somebody about something. As Seth drew near, he gathered that in this case, the person being lied to was Kevin's wife. "Feeling a little sick, to be honest," Kevin was saying, shaking his head at Seth to indicate that he was in fact feeling fine. "No, I'm still going. It means a lot to Seth. I'll just take it easy, skip the partying." Here Kevin grabbed his crotch to indicate that he did not intend to skip the partying. "I know, baby, I know. I am so sorry you can't come." "Right, you too. Bye." Kevin pocketed his phone, then with a swift and fluid motion, reached past Big Steve's still hovering finger and stabbed the boarding pass machine's screen. "Hey," said Big Steve, "what the hell?" Ignoring him, Kevin turned back to Seth. "You ready? Everything good in wedding land?" "I guess," said Seth. "There was an issue with the centerpieces." "What issue?" "I'm still not sure. A couple days ago, Tina calls me up. She's crying like she found out she has cancer. I mean, sobbing. And I go, 'What's wrong?' And she says something about the centerpieces. And I go, 'Hey, the important thing is we love each other and we're getting married.'" "You stupid," said Kevin. "I know." She goes, "I can't believe you sometimes," and hangs up.
We've just heard Dave Barry's Insane City. Miranda Hart is a popular British actress, comedian, and writer. She got her start studying drama at the Academy of Live and Recorded Arts, but luckily for us, she turned her attention to comedy. Miranda wrote material for the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, then landed some small roles in British sitcoms. She broke through in 2008 with her semi-autobiographical radio series, Miranda Hart's Joke Shop, on BBC Radio 2, which led to her BBC sitcom, Miranda, in 2009. Miranda's book, Is It Just Me?, are her reflections on a myriad of topics, including the struggles of attempting to sit elegantly on a bar stool, using chopsticks, pretending to understand the bank crisis, and pondering pedicures. Can it be cricket to have a stranger fondle your feet? Miranda, who narrates, offers up some much-needed caution and guidance on navigating life's rocky path. In fact, she thinks of the book as a much-needed manual, or shall we say, Miranual.
We looked back at what we'd wanted then and all that we had achieved. It was a lovely moment, and I heard myself punctuating the conversation with, "Life, eh?" When my little sister had a daughter, we sat with my newborn niece in our parents' garden, where she and I had often sat as young girls 30 years before. We said together wistfully, "Life, eh?" It says everything without having to say anything, that we all experience moments of joyful or painful reflection, sometimes alone, sometimes sharing laughs and tears with others, that we all know and appreciate that however wonderful and precious life is, it can equally be a terribly confusing and mysterious beast. Life, eh? Those kind of moments, the big ones, the meaty ones, the births, the deaths, the reminiscences, I can handle. Those kinds of moments I enjoy or endure, much as we all do. There's usually a sort of roadmap for them, traditions, procedure. But where I feel alone and unprepared is with the less serious but undeniably discombobulating and embarrassing hiccups, nuances and foibles of just being a person. Let me furnish you with a recent example. Has anyone else, whilst negotiating a slippery prawn in a smart restaurant, catapulted said prawn over their shoulder so it hit their next-door diner in the eye? Now, it is, of course, at times like this that one should remain very serious, stand, go over, perhaps say to the poor lady, "Are you all right? I'm terribly sorry. Could I get you another coffee?" The prawn, by the way, landed in her cappuccino and sank delicately through the foam. And generally make all the right social noises, but in that sort of situation, I get stuck in a helpless state of giggles and can't communicate at all. I couldn't help it. It was the noise of the prawn when it whacked her in the eye, a sort of dull splat. Of course I exploded into giggles and called her a bit of a name, Mrs. Prawn Eye, to be precise, and to her face, which didn't help. Nor did my trying to make her see the funny side by saying, "I wouldn't drink that coffee. It looks a bit fishy." Her stern look would normally have warned me off, but on seeing a prawn whisker on her lash, again, there was nothing to do but laugh. So I changed tack and regrettably, as sometimes happens, embarrassment tipped me into rage directed at the unfortunate waiter. "Excuse me, good sir, thank you very much to you, thank you. Now, can I just say, on behalf of both myself and poor Mrs. Prawn Eye, nay Whiskerlash here, that if I ordered prawns, I want them ready to put straight into my mouth, yes? I mean, why should I have to remove the inedible bits and do all the prawn administration, the prawnmen, if you will? So what's that you're saying? It's all part and parcel of eating prawns. Well, I tell you this, good sir, thank you to you. I quite firmly believe that any activity that is messy enough for a restaurant to provide me with a finger bowl should be carried out by the kitchen staff. Sorry, could you come back, please? What, excuse, wait, where are you going? No, no, I won't leave. I've paid for these prawns and I'm damned well going to finish them. No, you calm down. I'm sure you can imagine how the rest of the evening panned out. If you can't, it involved a security guard, 10 minutes hiding behind a wheelie bin and an illegally sourced chicken korma. In the grand scheme of things, I can see this experience is not so huge, but in the moment it feels like the toughest thing one will ever experience. I suppose what I'm trying to say is, does anyone else have trouble negotiating these sort of life hiccups, smart restaurants and all the accompanying etiquette, or is it just me? Worse still, is it just me, or has anyone else been on a date, thought it was going quite well, gone to the loo to have a breather, looked in the mirror and said, "Not too shabby, missus," then walked confidently back to the dining area, not realising that the loo roll was unwinding behind you from where it stuck in the back of your tights and swirling over other diners' heads, adorning the restaurant like a sort of streamer, then wondered, "Well, how on earth does one deal with this? Where's the flipping guidebook? There are thousands of years of writing devoted to dealing with birth, death, ageing, love and the meaning of it all, but absolutely nothing to tell me how to handle the indignity of briefly turning oneself into a human party popper to the immediate detriment of one's romantic prospects."
Excuse me.
Yes, hello. Who's rudely interrupting my tone, please?
It's me! Me! Your 18-year-old self, Miranda! Don't you recognise me? 6 foot tall, thin as a rail, school-issue straw boater, one red sock, one green sock and a lacrosse stick slung over my shoulder.
Oh, well, hello, my dear gangly young self. How absolutely lovely to see you in all your Mallory Towers finery. Why, I was just...
This isn't a social call, actually. No, I'm just a bit freaked out right now, as I don't particularly like the way you're talking, actually.
We've just heard Is It Just Me? By Miranda Hart. Christopher Buckley, a leading political satirist, dangles before us a tantalizing novel whose protagonist has more than a few things in common with a recent first lady. In no way to treat a first lady, Beth McIntyre has been charged with the murder of her husband, a presidential Lothario of the highest order. The murder weapon? A historic Paul Revere spittoon thrown during a bedroom spat, which, unfortunately, delivered a fatal dent in the president's lust-filled head. The Attorney General has no choice but to put Beth on trial for assassination. However, Beth has a secret weapon, the flashiest lawyer in the country, an unabashed high-priced shyster whom she loved while they were in law school together. The executive mansion rocks and rolls in this delightful tale, narrated by Grover Gardner.
Elizabeth Tyler McMahon, First Lady of the United States, lay awake in her own still crisp sheets, looking out the window toward the Washington Monument. Being married to America's most prominent symbol of virility, she was not blind to the irony of finding herself in bed alone, staring at the nation's most prominent phallic symbol. Not much had ever been lost on Beth McMahon, other than happiness. Following the dinner for the President of Uruguay, Beth and the President had left their remaining guests and gone upstairs at 11:30. They'd undressed and gotten into bed. She'd fallen asleep. She had woken up at 1:42 a.m. by the digital bedside clock, thirsty for water, to find herself alone. Sometimes, when a call came in the middle of the night, he went into his study so as not to disturb her. If it was a crisis of some sort, he usually went downstairs to the Oval Office. If it was really pressing, he would go to the Situation Room in the basement of the West Wing so that the press secretary could inform the press that the President had monitored the situation from the Situation Room. This sounded more impressive than on the phone in bed. The dark thought crossed Beth's mind, though she really, really preferred not to consider the possibility, that her husband was down the hall in the Lincoln bedroom. Surely he wouldn't pull something like that. Surely. She knew the rumors and, moreover, knew the truth about her philandering husband of many years. But even if the rumors were true, this was the one night it was safe to assume that her husband and Babette Van Anka, actress, singer, party fundraiser, were not engaging in bilateral relations. Beth sat up in bed, straining to convince herself that her husband was at this very minute downstairs issuing orders to attack some Middle Eastern or possibly Asian country with stealth weaponry. Just then she heard the click of the opening door as her husband, the President of the United States, came in. She knew instantly, even in the dark. No surer radar than a wife's intuition has been invented. Beth contemplated doing nothing, waiting until morning, when, after freshly squeezed orange juice, toast with butter and marmalade and black coffee, she could calmly confront him with this latest installment in his serial infidelity, then pour the coffee pot onto his offending parts. She contemplated this for 5 seconds, then flicked on the light. He reacted like any creature of the night, raccoon, cockroach, suddenly bathed in unwelcome illumination. There was a rapid lateral darting of the eyes, assessing avenues of flight. He was bent forward oddly, holding his jacket over his groin. Beth interpreted this posture as defensive. The body language shouted, "I've been screwing our guest." "Iraq," he said with a sigh. He rolled his eyes to show how grave and yet predictable was the situation. It occurred to Beth that Iraq now stood in danger. He might well wait until she had gone back to sleep, then slink off to the Situation Room and order a few cruise missiles launched at Baghdad, so that by breakfast time he could look her straight in the eyes. The argument that followed was boisterous even by the standards of the McMahon marriage, currently in its 25th and final year. Beth awoke as usual at 6:15. She picked up the phone on her bedside table and ordered her customary breakfast. She got out of bed, slipped on her bathrobe, and opened the door to collect the morning papers, which had, as usual, been placed neatly on a side table, in the order she preferred to read them. In many ways, the White House was the platonic ideal of the perfect hotel. 24-hour room service, a concierge at the end of the line eager to provide anything at all, from theater tickets to an army on the march. She scanned the front pages as she slipped back into bed. Nothing on Iraq. Surprise. An earthquake in Chile. The German foreign minister had given a speech saying that Germany had apologized sufficiently for World War II. A significant dinosaur bone had been found in Manitoba that paleontologists said might establish that dinosaurs had become extinct not because of a giant meteorite, but from osteoporosis. France, furious with the United States for imposing a 100% tariff on its Roquefort cheese, had agreed to sell China high-velocity nuclear torpedoes for its submarines. The head of Mexico's anti-narcotics police had just built himself a third palatial villa on a salary of $48,000 a year. With the presidential election only 18 months away, unnamed party leaders were concerned that the president's message was not getting out there. Sophie Williams, the White House maid who always brought the First Lady her breakfast, knocked softly and entered. She and Beth exchanged the usual pleasantries as she placed the breakfast tray with freshly cut orchid over Beth's lap. It was at this point that Sophie said to the First Lady, softly but with alarm, that the President's eyes and mouth were wide open, and that he was looking awful still. This remark set in motion a series of events that culminated 17 days later with Elizabeth Tyler McMahon's indictment for murdering the President of the United States of America. Had hers been an ordinary marriage, the charge would most likely have been second-degree murder. But since the husband in question was who he was, the plainly embarrassed Attorney General explained that he had no statutory choice but to charge the now former First Lady with a monstrous crime of assassination.
That was No Way to Treat a First Lady by Christopher Buckley. Tim Dorsey grew up in Riviera Beach, Florida. He graduated from Auburn, then worked from 1983 to 87 as a police and courts reporter for the Alabama Journal. He joined the Tampa Tribune in 1987, where he worked as a general assignment reporter, a political reporter in the Trib's Tallahassee Bureau, and night metro editor. He left the paper in August 1999 to write full-time. Tim has published 15 novels. One of his recent ones is The Pineapple Grenade, which we'll speak to him about today. Welcome, Tim. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
I appreciate you having me.
Early on in the book, you have your character Serge say, "I live for Florida, and she's been disintegrating for decades. I've tried sounding the alarm." Is this environmental destruction of our state the factor for your writing?
I don't think it's limited to any particular plateau. I mean, everything's falling apart. But it's, you know, it's in Florida at least, it looks pretty well. It collapses, you know. But basically, neighborhoods, common courtesy. I mean, we're all at each other's throats down here, and of course, but. You know, my bread and butter is, you know, the weird criminal police blotters. So that part of it, I don't want to stop, you know, because it's, I won't be able to write.
How did you choose the title of the book, Pineapple Grenade?
The titles of my books, you want to kind of convey in like two words maybe, you know, a sense of tropicalness, but also that it's noir and off balance. And it goes into detail about what a pineapple grenade is in the book. But it's also, you know, it's tropical but explosive. Yeah.
Okay. In the book, you write about a shark spotted on public transportation on the Metro Mover, actually. Of course, this was a true story. And as Carl Hyacin always says, he couldn't make up this stuff. So I guess you agree?
Yes, and the funny thing is, when I throw that stuff in, people just think I'm just outlandishly crazy and nuts, you know, outside of Florida, you know, and oh yeah, shark in the street, yeah, bright, you know, and everybody in Florida's like, he's got a subscription to the newspaper, you know, so I started with that, and that is like a recurring theme, the shark keeps showing up, you know, I start out the morning, you know, looking at the various newspapers and reading stuff online and just making notes. And that was in my notes coming into writing this book. And I had to use it since I was going to have the book be in Miami.
Yeah. So do you, Dave Barry and Carl Hyacin, ever sit in a room and swap bizarre true stories?
No. It's a small world. My brother-in-law tiled Carl's house. And Dave and I recently had dinner in Tampa when the Republican National Convention was there. So we were swapping stories over dinner not deliberately, but we were just laughing about different weird stuff that had been going on.
Is Serge based on anybody?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, actually, the guy I see in the mirror each morning.
Your alter ego, huh?
Well, no, actually just my ego.
Okay.
It's just straight up, except I have impulse control. So when I get mad at these people, instead of killing them, I sit down because people ask, how do you come up with such inventive, sadistic ways to kill people? And I'm like, inspiration. I just, you know, I meet these jerks and I'm driving home and I'm so angry. I'm like, this is what I'm going to do to them. And then I got a couple chapters when I get home.
And what about Coleman, Sergius Sancho Panza?
He's a guy who went to school with in college. True. I mean, believe me, I can't tell you how many things actually he did that I attribute to Coleman.
And his name will be protected forever.
Yeah, yeah. He doesn't know he's Coleman, but he reads the books. And it's funny because he gives me feedback. And he goes, oh, yeah, I read your latest book. Yeah, it was really good. Oh, that Coleman. And I go, yeah.
Dude, what are you smoking?
Yeah, yeah. He would call me, tell me crazy stories, and go right in the next book.
Serge has appeared in several of your books. When you first created him, did you know he was going to be a recurring character?
No. He was going to just be a villain. But when I started building his backstory and having him bump off people, I just said, well, what would be kind of entertaining to or creative to come up with? And I thought about my journalism days, you know, because you report on so many stories, but the ones that stick in your mind are particularly, you know, the people who are just really arrogant and predatory. And so I had fun dealing with them, and I started having, as in the first draft, I had so much fun with Serge that I realized he's the main character. And so on subsequent drafts, I, you know, finagled the book so that he would be the lead guy. So no, it was never a plan. It just happened.
So Pineapple Grenade is a wild ride, but it's actually scathing political commentary, right?
I don't know. I have a lot of fun. My third book, Orange Crush, I was a reporter up in Tallahassee, and I find politics hilarious. I mean, I can never stop laughing at it. And I know it's a kind of stereotype to, you know, or cliche to make fun of politicians. So I'm not out to attack as much as I am to make myself laugh, you know. So sorry people, if you got offended, you know, it's hilarious to me.
Speaking of which, your reflections on Florida's meritorious performance in the vote counting in the last election?
Yeah, I put a post up about that, and on Facebook, and I never had so many people, you know, reply to it. And then by the end, you know, there are all these, because I showed this voting line, and I said, you know, and because this was, you know, it was 3 days out, and we still hadn't declared a winner for Florida, and so I declared a winner. I said, you know, and I showed this long line. I said, and the winner in Florida is Dr. Scholes, you know, and. And then I just, you know, kind of wrote a few more things, you know, about the, because I went in, I wasn't paying attention. I was on the road, and I was going to be on the road from, anyway, what happened is I went into early vote, and I walked into my library, you know, the one where there's the early voting, and I'm looking around, and I see this one room where all these people are in line, right? And so I walked in, and I got in line, and I'm looking, and then the person at the front started doing something, and they all started doing these weird, it was a yoga class, it wasn't voting lines, and so I'm like, so I left, and I went and I go, where's the early voting? And they go, oh, it's only 1 week this year, not two. And I'm like, so I voted absentee because I was going to be on the road through the election.
Is there hope for Florida?
Hope not. No, it's too good of a place. A writer could not have a location for better material.
Do you have an urge to write about anywhere else?
Every once in a while, but not as much as Florida. I mean, each year, as I'm writing, you know, obviously you see and you read stuff that's not going to fit in that book, so you just put it in your file. I have a computer file, and I just put stuff in there. And so by the time it's time to write the next book and start outlining it, there's just so much Florida I want to get back to that. And I have done, I went to Hollywood briefly in one of the books, but it was about Florida in the movies. You know, Serge wanted to straighten out, you know, the fact that they don't treat Florida correctly and accurately. And so, so I went out there for a little bit.
And are you already at work on the new book?
Next one's done. As a matter of fact, the one after that is virtually done. If you want to know more, visit my website, timdorsey.com, no space, or just do a search engine for me and it'll pop up.
Okay. Well, readers, this was a really fun book with a little bit of a bite. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, really appreciate it. I was glad to do it.
And now let's listen to a sampling of Tim Dorsey's Pineapple Grenade, narrated by Oliver Wyman.
A river of headlights inched through the humid dusk along the Palmetto Expressway. An inbound Continental jet from Houston cleared the highway and touched down at Miami International. Then, a United flight from Oklahoma City. Serge snapped a photo out the window of a green and orange 1968 Plymouth Roadrunner. They took the next exit. Coleman looked around a dark neighborhood of burglar bars and darting shadows, then back up at the parallel elevated expressway with a row of reassuring streetlights.
"I'd feel a lot safer if we were still on that other road."
"And that's exactly why we're down here."
The needle dipped under 30 as Serge leaned over the steering wheel. Coleman leaned over his bong.
"Why are we down here?"
"Miami's gotten an unfair reputation just because of all the tourist murders. I blame the media."
"It's not right."
"And ground zero of this herd-thinning epidemic is the ancillary roads around the airport, where roving bands of land pirates cruise for unsuspecting visitors in rental cars who get lost and take the wrong exit. So we took the wrong exit."
"But we're only two guys," said Coleman. "How can we change things?"
"All it takes is one headline."
Coleman looked down at himself.
"Is that why we're dressed like this?"
Serge floored the gas and cut his lights.
"What are you doing?"
"Here's our headline."
On the shoulder of a dim and deserted access road, a retired tool-and-die salesman from Bowling Green stood next to his wife behind their rented Taurus. At gunpoint. The carjacker heard something and turned.
"What the—"
A screech of brakes. The assailant went up over the front bumper, then bounced off the windshield and landed at the feet of the shaken couple. Serge jumped out with his own gun. The couple's hands went back up.
"Put your arms down," said Serge.
He grabbed the wrist of the would-be thief for a pulse.
"I'm not robbing you. I'm rescuing you."
The man squinted in the darkness at Serge's leotard and flowing red cape, then his chest.
"Superman?"
"No, that's a different S. I'm Serge."
The woman stared at a passenger climbing out the other side of the Plymouth.
"Who's that?"
Serge glanced over the roof at Coleman, wearing a plain white t-shirt with flames drawn in red magic marker.
"The Human Torch."
Coleman waved cheerfully and lit a joint. Serge dragged the carjacker by the ankles and threw him in the trunk. Then he walked back to the driver's door.
"I gotta run in my tights."
He looked up.
"Welcome to Miami. Please tell the media."
"Tell them what?" Serge gathered up his cape and put on a helmet with a revolving red light.
"Everything's normal."
A Plymouth Roadrunner raced east on the Palmetto Expressway. Another overhead thunder of Pratt and Whitney jet engines. Outside the airport, people on cell phones covered free ears. Arriving passengers looked up from the curb as an Aeromexico 747 roared on takeoff. The airliner quickly gained altitude. It reached the edge of the Everglades and banked over a patchwork of water-filled limestone quarries. Between two of the quarries, a dozen men in jumpsuits looked up at the drone from the Cancun-bound flight. Its moonlit contrail disappeared in the clouds. The sound faded to crickets. Back to work. It was an old barn of a warehouse, sun-baked, remote, corrugated aluminum. Used to be an airplane hangar with two huge doors that slid open on rusty tracks. The doors had a single row of windows, long since spray-painted black.
That was Pineapple Grenade by Tim Dorsey. According to the Book Report's executive producer, Derek Hewitt, any show on humor must include the incomparable P.G. Woodhouse. So, it is my pleasure to present Something Fresh, Book One in the Blandings Castle series.
Sadly, the one thing that can always be expected to disturb the peace at Blandings is the incursion of imposters. In this edition, Blandings has imposters like other houses have mice. This time, there are two imposters, both intent on mischief and mayhem. Jonathan Cecil narrates.
Having saved a little money at this dreadful trade, Ash came to London and tried newspaper work. After 2 years of moderate success, he got in touch with the Mammoth Publishing Company. The Mammoth Publishing Company, which controls several important newspapers, a few weekly journals, and a number of other things, does not disdain the pennies of the office boy and the junior clerk. One of its many profitable ventures is a series of paper-covered tales of crime and adventure. It was here that Ash found his niche. Those Adventures of Gridley Quayle Investigator, which are so popular with a certain section of the reading public, were his work. Until the advent of Ash and Mr. Quayle, the British Pluck Library had been written by many hands, and it included the adventures of many heroes. But in Gridley Quayle, the proprietors held that the ideal had been reached, and Ash received a commission to conduct the entire British Pluck Library monthly himself. On the meagre salary paid him for these labours, he'd been supporting himself ever since. That was how Ash came to be in Arundel Street, Leicester Square, on this May morning. He was a tall, well-built, fit-looking young man with a clear eye and a strong chin, and he was dressed, as he closed the front door behind him, in a sweater, flannel trousers, and rubber-soled gymnasium shoes. In one hand he bore a pair of Indian clubs, in the other a skipping rope. Having drawn in and expelled the morning air in a measured and solemn fashion, which the initiated observer would have recognized as that scientific deep breathing which is so popular nowadays, he laid down his clubs, adjusted his rope, and began to skip. When one considers how keenly London, like all large cities, resents physical exercise, unless taken with some practical and immediate utilitarian object in view, this young man's calm as he did this peculiar thing was amazing. The rules governing exercise in London are clearly defined. You may run if you're running after a hat or an omnibus. You may jump if you do so with the idea of avoiding a taxicab or because you've stepped on a banana skin. But if you run because you wish to develop your lungs, or jump because jumping is good for the liver, London punishes you with its mockery. It rallies round and points the finger of scorn. Yet this morning, Arundel Street bore the spectacle absolutely unmoved. Due west, the proprietor of the Hotel Previtali leant against his hostelry, his mind an obvious blank. Due north, the proprietor of the Hotel Mathis propped up his caravanserai, manifestly thinking of nothing. In various windows of the two hotels, the upper portions of employees appeared, and not a single employee ceased his task for a moment to fling a jibe. Even the little children who infested the court forbore to scoff, and the customary cat, rubbing itself against the railings, rubbed down without a glance. The whole thing affords a remarkable object lesson of what a young man can achieve with patience and perseverance. When he had taken the second floor front of number 7A 3 months before, Ash Marston had realized that he must forget those morning exercises which had become a second nature to him, or else defy London's unwritten law and brave London's mockery. He had not hesitated long. Physical fitness was his gospel. On the subject of exercise, he was confessedly a crank. He decided to defy London. The first time he appeared in Arundel Street in his sweater and flannels, he had barely whirled his Indian clubs once round his head before he had attracted the following audience. A. Two cabmen, one intoxicated. B. Four waiters from the Hotel Mathis. C. Six waiters from the Hotel Previtali. D. Six chambermaids from the Hotel Mathis. E. Five chambermaids from the Hotel Previtali. F. The proprietor of the Hotel Mathis. G. The proprietor of the Hotel Previtali. H. A street cleaner. I. 11 nondescript loafers. J. 27 children. K. A cat. They all laughed, even the cat, and kept on laughing. The intoxicated cabman called Ash Bill Bailey, and Ash kept on swinging his clubs.
That was a sampling of Something Fresh by P.G. Woodhouse. Jen Lancaster hates the message that a woman's true happiness is based on whether or not she can fit into her skinny jeans. Girls, we all know about that issue. But as Lancaster turned 40, she realized that being overweight wasn't simply a societal issue that might be fixed with a dose of positive self-esteem. No, ma'am. The battle of the bulge is a serious health issue. In Such a Pretty Fat, one narcissist's quest to discover if her life makes her butt look big or why pie is not the answer, Lancaster gives us a hilarious look at the trials and tribulations of weight loss. Jamie Heinlein narrates.
There's a maple-glazed pork roast browning nicely in the oven, and white chocolate chip macadamia cookies cooling on a rack farther down the counter. I've already sautéed the almonds, and am waiting for the green beans to blanch so I can toss the whole lot with yet more butter before serving the meal. That sucks, he sympathetically replies. What happened? Well, I waited on the corner for a cab for, like, 20 minutes and none came. So I jumped on the Western Avenue bus to take it to the Blue Line. I stir the potatoes before sampling them. Do these need more horseradish? Taste. I attempt to walk over to Fletch, but our dogs, Maisie and Loki, attracted by all the delicious smells wafting from the kitchen, have firmly stationed their combined 165 pounds of bulk directly in my path. Move, I bark. They back up about an inch and plant themselves again. They know very well that in 15 minutes I'll be feeding them bites of pork roast off my fork, and thus are going nowhere. I continue. A couple of stops after I got on, this hippie girl boards with a stroller, and the first thing I think is, oh, honey, you are a baby. You can't have a baby. Anyway, instead of standing in the area meant for strollers up front, she moves toward me. I get up, ostensibly so she can take my seat, walk to the very back, and sit down. I taste the potatoes again. You know what these need? Wine. Wine? Yes. I mean, in a glass, for me to drink. Pour me some? I can't get around these idiots. I gesture at the dogs, and they both leap up to snap at the butter dripping from the wooden spoon. I'd say these are the most lazy, self-indulgent creatures on the planet, but that would discount my rotten cats, who keep hopping onto the counter and trying to grab the spoon with their paws. Listen up, creatures. If anyone's licking this butter, it's going to be me. Fletch grabs some of Trader Joe's finest $5 Pinot Grigio for me and a bottle of water for himself. He pauses before selecting a glass from the cabinet over the coffee maker. Every shelf is packed with flutes, tulips, goblets, martini glasses, and rocks tumblers. We've got the proper vessels for ports and sherries and Rhine wines and cognac. You can have a beer in amounts varying from 8 to 32 ounces in pilsners or pints. Some glasses have obscenely long stems, some have no stems at all, and some have delicate flowers etched in thin crystal. The thing is, they're completely unnecessary. We have something like three friends who will brave our dog's enthusiastic expressions of affection. Sure, it's funny to hear stories about how our pit bull, Maisie the Love Monster, can leap 4 feet in an attempt to kiss visitors, only to split lips and blacken eyes, but it's less charming when it's your head that's bleeding. Our shepherd, Loki, stands more than 5 feet tall on his talon-tipped hind legs and has a penchant for salad tossing, so his greetings are less than desirable, too. Please consult UrbanDictionary.com if you don't know what this means. I'm not explaining it. And since only two of the three people still willing to enter our home actually drink, our stash of beverage containers is a tad overwhelming. I have no idea where they all came from, and am equally dismayed that, despite intentional carelessness, none ever seem to break. I can't bring myself to get rid of perfectly good stemware, so we live with them hogging up an entire set of cabinets. Daunted by the lot of them on display, Fletch finally chooses one of our 15 multi-purpose models and pours me a healthy belt of white wine. Here you go. Thanks. I take a quick sip to wet my throat.
We've just heard Such a Pretty Fat by Jen Lancaster. Readers, a good book is the perfect antidote to projects that tax your spirit. For a comprehensive list of entertaining titles, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Good luck with the tax man, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.